Hello, this is Terrence McNally. Midterms are over. Sessions has been fired. Trump has 2 months till the new House arrives. I'm on vacation and can't respond to any of that. This week you'll hear my April 2010 conversation with Father Greg Boyle, founder of Homeboy Industries, and we're joined by Luis Perez, one of the senior staff at Homeboy. My guests and their work run absolutely counter to the kinds of prejudice and ugliness indulged in by the president. As a pastor working in a neighborhood with the highest concentration of deadly gang activity in Los Angeles, Gregory Boyle created an organization to provide jobs, training, and encouragement so that young people, often former enemies, could work together and learn the mutual respect that comes from collaboration. "Nothing stops a bullet like a job" is the slogan of Homeboy Industries. Probably the best story form is the one used in sermons, stories with lessons. And Father Boyle has made a point of collecting and telling uniquely powerful stories of life and death, and his work has supplied him with more than anyone should know. He has so far buried 168 of his homies and fills his first book, Tattoos on the Heart, with their stories. I read it cover to cover on a plane flight, Chicago to L.A., and cried at least a dozen times. Boyle's compassion is boundless, his work is courageous, and his example is a profound challenge. I highly recommend the book, Tattoos on the Heart. On Free Forum, we explore the lives, the work, the ideas of individuals that I suspect have pieces of the puzzle of a world that just might work. We look at new, innovative, provocative approaches to business, environment, health, science, politics, media, all based on the fact that I believe we can do better, and I want to find out how. Father Gregory Boyle was ordained a Jesuit minister in 1982. He received his Master of Divinity from the Weston School of Theology and a Sacred Theology Master's degree from the Jesuit School of Theology. Since 1986, Father Gregory Boyle has been the pastor of Dolores Mission in the Boyle Heights neighborhood of Los Angeles. The church sits between two large public housing projects, Pico Gardens and Aliso Village, known for decades as the gang capital of the world. In 1988, Father Boyle began what would become Homeboy Industries, now located in downtown L.A., and his first book is Tattoos on the Heart. Welcome, Gregory Boyle, to Pacifica and Free Forum.
Thank you, Terrence.
And you brought with you someone from Homeboy Industries?
Luis Perez, who was one of my senior staff there.
Welcome, Luis.
Oh, thank you very much.
Okay, I'm going to end up talking with Father Gregory most of the time, but how long have you been at Homeboy?
I've been working with Homeboy Industries now for going on 6 years. It's just the real reason that I'm here today is because of Father Greg.
I believe that. And it's Sunday, so we're in church here at noon. I like listeners to get a feel for the people behind the ideas and the work that we end up talking about on the show. So just to put a piece of background on it, where in Los Angeles did you grow up? Because I know you did. And what was your awareness or your thought process about gangs in those years?
Well, I grew up in the Wilshire area. I have five sisters and two brothers and lived over, in St. Brendan's Parish, if that means anything to anybody. And so, went to elementary school and Catholic school and high school and it was a pretty isolated life. I wouldn't say we were wealthy by any means, but we were, able to go to Catholic schools and to have a job every, a summer or, whenever I was of an age to work. So my consciousness of gangs was non-existent. I wouldn't know where to find one if you sent me on a scavenger hunt, So I didn't know what a gang member looked
like. And those years were the late 70s, early 80s?
Yeah, 60s, yeah. 70s.
Uh-huh. Yeah.
And then so I really had never had an encounter with a gang member until I was assigned as a pastor at Dolores Mission Parish.
And how old were you then?
Oh, God, I was probably just 30, 31 uh-huh. maybe.
Okay. And let me go back a little bit more. You went to Catholic schools. Did you learn at all about what I would call liberation theology?
No, liberation theology didn't really quite exist at that point. It was really more later on. So when I studied theology, that was just the beginnings of it. Gustavo Gutierrez and people like that and John Sobrino. So I used to study that, and I was in Bolivia. And of course, Latin America was just soaked with it in those days. Luis Espinal was In fact, the house where I live now is called Casa Luis Espinal. He was a Jesuit who was killed by the government there in Bolivia. And so that was all part of the air you breathed in Latin America in those days. And, of course, that would have been 84. And in fact, I was just defending a gang member in Maryland on a death penalty case. And the prosecutor said, "Isn't it true, Father Boyle, that you're a proponent of liberation theology," as if this was some damning. I said, "Well, I've read some books. I don't know, proponent. And isn't it true that Dolores Mission was an activist church?" And this again, I said, I guess if you're trying to get me to feel guilty for this, boy, keep trying, because it's the farthest I'm proud of.
It's so funny. You can just see the quotes around activist and liberation.
Yeah. And not only that, he said fasts and protests and civil
sanctuary.
Sanctuary and civil disobedience. I go, yeah. guilty as charged, you know. So it was just crazy. I didn't know what he wanted to say. But it was a way of discrediting my own history in that community. So
yeah. How old were you when you decided to be a priest?
Well, I was pretty young. In those days, that was a more common thing than it is now, and that's probably a good thing. I had an uncle who was a Jesuit, and I was educated by Jesuits. So when I was 18, I did it. So
I'm Terrence McNally, brought up Catholic.
So you know all that stuff.
I certainly, I think in my early, 10, 11, 12, 13, it was like
It was part of what you did. You know, every Irish family had a priest in it, you know, pretty much, you know. But the thing for me was I loved these guys. They were completely hilarious. They were the most fun people I'd ever been around, the ones who taught me. And then they were all cutting edge. This is, you know, I used to go to my first protests with a band of Jesuits. This is during the Vietnam War. And so I thought, wow, you know, they're on the edge. They're prophetic, and they're hilarious. That seemed like a combo burger I couldn't pass up.
No, I hear that. Yeah. I mean, I can't say that in truth, I don't think I had any one priest that was that, you know, exceptional, like kind of an example. So for me, it remained a little abstract.
Well, there were lots of them at Loyola High at the time, and they wanted to set the world on fire, and I wanted to along with them. So that's why I entered.
Yeah. The church... I just want to deal with this a little bit before we move on. The church has had its share of problems, obviously, with abuse scandals and so on over the last several years. Has any of that ever impinged on your thoughts about your own vocation and your own life?
Well, I mean, it does in as much as it's tragic and sad and heartbreaking, and it colors the kind of the climate and the environment in which you do ministry, without question. And so, especially, we've had this resurgence lately in the press. And although I have to admit that where I work and with whom I work, there's sort of a bubble or an isolation from that. You know, I mean, it's not front burner. It's not a thing that comes up, whereas it would in parishes where people are kind of more attuned to news, I suppose.
Yeah.
And in at our place, you know, there's so much up against stuff. You know, people are just trying to figure out
immediate stuff.
They're trying to survive, and so it's not so front burner. But it, obviously, you hope that it becomes this opportunity, as any crisis can be if you let it, to open the windows a little bit more and let fresh air in and transparency out. You know.
Yeah.
And kind of be more like Jesus and kind of what Jesus hoped to found at the beginning of all this.
Yeah. You mentioned Bolivia. I know that trip to Bolivia you took was crucial in your life path, really. And how old were you when you did that, and what did you do there?
Well, I was just recently ordained, and so part of the idea was to get my Spanish improved, and so ostensibly it was language study. But then when I was there, I went and I started to do ministry, and you know, and then I just kind of fell in love with the people and wanted to be with the poor, and that kind of turned me inside out. It was really a time of great conversion, and then so by the time I got back to California. And I was supposed to go to Santa Clara University. I thought, no, that's not enough for me. you know, I really want to work with the poor. Though I think what I was supposed to do there was connect the students at Santa Clara with the poor, but that still was not enough. So I asked my provincial, and he let me go to Dolores Mission, and then so I've been there pretty much ever since.
And when you went to Dolores Mission, did you know its environment, its context, what you were taking on?
I did a little bit, only in as much as I had spent two summers there, 84 and 85, before I became pastor in 86. So I don't think I knew any of the gang stuff. And even initially, the issue was principally people who were undocumented and immigrant issues. And then by 88, I was starting to bury young people killed because of gang violence. And then, and because I was walking in the projects every day and night, I thought, wow, here were all these disaffected youth who were mired really in a sense of despair and unable to imagine a future. So then that became quite on the forefront of all our minds at the parish, not just myself.
I've said in the introduction of the show that Tattoos in the Heart, your book, brought me to tears several times. Profound book. So many stories of young men gunned down. And it seems the ones that get you the most are the ones who are on the path to redemption, or who seem redeemed. They're about to have their first child. They're about to, you know, do this or that, and then there's. Speak just a little bit about that, and if you also want to chime in,
Lewis,
just
yeah. I mean, we both have many friends who've died, you know, and. Part of those stories sometimes feel unfair to people because they think, you know, I tell a story about a kid who was our foreman at the bakery. And then you have his friends saying, what's the point of doing good, as they would say, if this can happen to you, that you can get gunned down. And so it was a question that needed to be answered. And my answer, as I preached in front of this whole group of his friends, you know, packed church, was that this kid had come to know the truth of who he was, that he was exactly what God had in mind when God made him. And so, in fact, he had inhabited that truth and become that truth. And no bullet can pierce it, and no four prison walls can keep it out. And there are a lot of things worse than death, and not knowing that truth happens to be one of them. So you want to get people to a place of death has no power. I just did a funeral of Friday morning. It was actually of a little baby. But that's a thing we say in terms of our faith. You know, la muerte ya no tiene dominio. You know, death has no dominion. It has no power. Well, what does that mean? You know, and unless you can come to terms with that, then you're really shaken at the roots. And you don't want to be. You want to be able to be the sort of samurai, you know, the already dead one, the one who kind of knows, you know, knowing the truth is more powerful. And loving is one of the reasons why death has no power. But, you know, like your friend who, remember the one who you were talking about who was going to change his life?
Yeah.
Tell that story.
Yeah, so let me just tell people. I'm Terrence McNally. This is a Free Forum, and I'm speaking with Father Gregory Boyle, one of the founders of Homeboy Industries and the author of Tattoos on the Heart. And he's brought with him this afternoon Luis Perez, who has been working at Homeboy for 6 years.
Yeah, just like Tattoos on the Heart, it's a place, Homeboys is a place where stories are held, you know. It's a place where stories create kinship between, in our community, between gang members. And, you know, the way I ended up at Homeboys was because I had a friend, and I had just been released from being incarcerated. And this guy was going to college. He was doing all the things that I felt and I thought that I could not accomplish in my own life. And I remember one day we were just hanging out in the corner and we were speaking, and he was saying that unfortunately, because of the way he looked and because of the record he had, that there was no place that were allowing him the opportunity to seek employment. And he was talking about going to Homeboy Industries, a place where hope, you know, was there, you know, and he was saying, maybe Father Greg will allow me to have a job there. And, you know, because of my being incarcerated most of my life as a juvenile, Father Greg did my first communion in camp. I was like, yeah, you know, go down to Homeboys, you know, Father Greg will help you. I know that, you know, and what ended up happening, we conversated, we played around, and I ended up leaving earlier home, you know, and what ended up happening, we used to live on the same street, and we would meet up on a street called Olympic Boulevard right there where I grew up. And we would meet up and walk.
This, the friend that you were speaking
yeah,
to.
Yeah, the friend we were speaking to. And we used to walk to where we used to hang out at in our street. And one day he called me, and unfortunately I wasn't there to answer the phone, and he decided to walk to our block on his own. And as he was walking, someone seen him. They did a U-turn, came back, and shot him 3 times lifeless, left him lifeless on the middle of the street. You know, Homeboy Industry is a place where hope is created, you know, and from what he did, my friend Marcos, after it inspired me to go and seek Father Greg, and I walked into Broken, I walked into Homeboy Industries, and I asked Father Greg if he had remembered me from camp. He did. I shed some tears, heartbroken of my friends, of my loss of my friend, and he was like, of course I remember you, you know, and I told him, I want to change my life, I need help. He said, okay, you start Monday. And that was the beginning, first steps.
That was your job interview.
Yeah, yeah, that was my job interview, right? It was not, I wasn't judged on my appearance. I wasn't judged the way I looked or the past that I, the past mistakes that I had done. I was judged for the inner heart that Father Greg had the opportunity to see inside me that I couldn't see at the moment myself, you know? And that's the beautiful thing that happens at Homeboy Industry is that you can't judge a book by its cover or by its first chapter. But you're judged by the desire and the want for more out of your life. And that's what happened, takes place there.
So that was 6 years ago?
Yes. The first 2 years, like I told you, once I was hired, I was still transitioning. You know, it's not only a fight. It's, you know, sometimes people have the idea that, oh, your friends are not going to allow this or whatever. But the actual fight takes place in yourself. The desire, it has to be inside
yourself. The fight to stay with that new path?
Yeah. You know, once habits are formed, it's hard to break. So you have to build new habits. So it takes a transition to go through that. So the first 2 years, I was still kind of transitioning. I was still kind of understanding what was going on there, a place where you see rival gang members work side by side on a daily basis. People that I had been incarcerated or because of the area I grew up at or the area they grew up, we shouldn't have got along. But that wasn't occurring there. What you were seeing was a place where kinship was in the community that we have is just because of the surroundings and the compassion and love that Father Greg offers to all of us, it creates it between ourselves.
Wow.
And, you know, I made a couple bad choices. I was still, I felt that I didn't deserve better than what I had.
And so
I sabotaged and I went back out and I was looking at 15 years. Incarcerated because I'm a two striker, and then I finally thought of all those times that I had spent with Father Greg and at the office and all the opportunities and how I was loved no matter how bad I made a mistake that allowed me to finally love myself. And once being released, I entered a transitional living home, a halfway house. Started going back to college. You got straight A's, except the B in Spanish. I don't know what happened there. ended up going back. And, you know, in my times while I was still out there active and, still messing with drug addiction and stuff.
Messing
up and stuff. I ended up approaching Father Greg, and he would tell me, no, my son, you don't need a job at the moment. You need help. And I came back months later after coming out of college, doing college and the halfway house, and I showed up and Father Greg was walking out and he seen me, he looked into my eyes and said, hey, I'm here, you know, he's like, you start Monday. And I've been working there ever since now. My position there is a senior navigator. And what I do is I walk with people. I hold the mirror like Father Greg held the mirror up for me and try to return people back to themselves, the true self. not for the mistakes or the hardships they've been through, but for the true self that they have inside them, you know, and
so
you just guide them.
So this job of navigator, this is not about dispatching trucks or something, right?
Yeah, no, it's this is dispatching souls.
So you're like a counselor? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah.
So you're like a counselor to people?
Yeah, a counselor. And the way that we work is, you know, I've been through there, you know, and since I've been there and I've done that and I've gotten out of the hole, you know, I'm able to go in the hole with them and help them get out, show them the way out. So I guide them, you know, like a navigational system.
Yeah.
I guide them and give them the directions of what they need to do to proceed for a better life.
And my guess is that your navigation is more trustworthy since you've been where they've been.
Yeah.
It's not just where you're going, but it's...
Yeah, exactly. I work with guys that at one time I know them from history. They know my history of where I came from. And I also work with guys that at one time I even shot at. And today we're friends.
Yeah.
You know, and because we've come to an understanding that everything that I suffered, he suffered just in a different area. And pretty much the reason that I hated him was because really I hated myself. And now since I've been able to love myself, I'm able to love other people.
Yeah, great. That's the words of Luis Perez.
Yes.
Correct. He's a navigator at Homeboy Industries. He's been there for 6 years now. I'm Terrence McNally. I'm speaking with Luis and Father Gregory Boyle, the founder of Homeboy Industries and the author of a new book that I highly recommend, Tattoos on the Heart, The Power of Boundless Compassion. You can learn more at homeboyindustries.org. Back to you, Father. He mentioned he can be a mirror. And the mirror, I remember, comes up in the story you tell of the first homie you ever buried. Tell that story.
Yeah, it's not so much a story as it is an image. It's the story of a guy named Robert, whose brother Rafael was killed, and they were identical twins. I mean, even the mom couldn't tell them apart. And so it was the striking image. This was 1988, the very first kid I buried, killed because of gang violence. And there was Robert peering into his brother Rafael's casket, and they just happened to be wearing the identical clothes, and it was like somebody had slapped a mirror down on this casket, and somebody was peering in at their exact mirror image. So it's a little, for me, it was because it was the first burial, it stood as sort of the first image of what this is, you know, all the people that Lewis talks about who were enemies, you know. Well the truth is they came from the same difficult, sometimes traumatic backgrounds. They shared the same streets, basically, and the same kind of environment, and the same sense of pervasive despair. And yet they're killing each other, you know, and yet they're twins. They're sort of identical. They're brothers.
So yeah.
So that was kind of an image that sort of has stayed with me.
I'm sure. And I love stories. I believe they're the most powerful, you know, tools we have. As I said, the sermon is the story with the lesson, the story with the lesson. So I am going to ask you to tell a few more, which is what Tattoos in the Heart is full of. The character that you call Sharky.
Keep in mind that the Simon and Schuster people.
I know, changed the name. So you don't know if I named somebody.
Well, if you just give me a trigger other than the name, because I can't remember who any of the names are.
On him, I he's the one from whom the title of the book comes from.
Oh, yeah. So that was just I don't mention a lot of things in the book about this kid. One was he was kind of a player, as we would say, a ladies' man. And so he got in a fight and he lost two big front teeth. And he kept saying, send me to a dentist. And I said, I will. You have to make the appointment. I'll pay for it. I'll take care of it. I knew a dentist, but you have to make the appointment. I don't mention that in the book. So he keeps calling me and he says, could you call the dentist? I said, look, I told you I'm going to pay for it, but I'm asking you to make the appointment. So you just, well, I can't. I'm too embarrassed. So anyway, that was the setup that I don't mention in the book because he was just aggravating me. And I remember I was in Chicago. I called, returned his phone call, and I was madder in hell because he kept badgering me. And I said, I've told you what to do. And then I thought, why am I giving him such a hard time? Because then I realized the kid had actually stepped away from the gang life. And then I thought, I just shifted. I said, look, you're my hero. look where you were and look where you are now, and you've really kind of stepped away from all that stuff that used to bring you to darkness and sadness, and I'm just so proud to know you, and you're my hero. And then there was this silence. I thought he had hung up on me. And he said, damn, gee, I'm going to tattoo that on my heart. Yeah. So that became kind of tattoos on the heart, sort of, again, not so much a story as a vignette, as an
yeah.
image.
Yeah.
Some things are full-blown
yeah.
Shaggy Dog stories, and then others are just kind of snapshots and images, you know, so... But that's where the title comes from.
Yeah, exactly. And the book is, as I say, yeah, it's not they're not all fully developed. Here's the hero, the journey, the so on. But the book comes alive because it is just it's just these sometimes full blown stories, sometimes just snatches. But it's life that most of us never see.
And in my homilies, you know, I just came from saying mass at one of the probation camps, like the camp where I met Lewis. You know, and this was camp. Page, were you ever there?
No.
It's out in Laverne, and so my homilies always have three stories. So you know,
what was today?
Well, I had one story was from the book, but the others were. One was a story about Joseph, who we know, who we were at the company picnic, which we have. You know, we have 427 employees, so people bring their ladies and their. And their
children,
their boyfriends, or their kids. You know, you can get 800 people there. So, so I was we were eating lunch. You know, and Joseph, I noticed on his calf because he had shorts on, he had a paragraph tattooed to the back of his leg. Do you know this story?
Yeah.
Yeah, and so I said, "What's that?" He goes, "It's a letter from my son, my oldest son." And then I read the letter, which is just a heartbreaking letter about. That he tattooed it when he had overdosed, and the kid had gone to the hospital and just handed him this letter, and it basically said, "You have to stop using drugs," you know, and it's a heartbreaking letter. But he tattooed the entire letter to his calf so he can read it every day. The next story I told was about the man sitting next to me here. He doesn't know that, but the story was about we got invited to this international gang conference in Toronto. So I had to find two of my staff, my senior staff, who had passports. So Lewis was one and Fabian was the other. And so we fly to New York, then we fly to Toronto. And, you know, they're checking my passport. We got separated at one point. I get flagged on and I'm fine. These guys get pulled over.
Because of their records?
Well, they start to run them, and then all of a sudden they thought their resumes were too long. And
their resumes.
And they wouldn't let them in. And I said, well, you know, your government has paid for us to fly here. And they said, we're not letting these two guys in. And the moral of that story was, I talked about there's a Ruskin quote where he says, if you want somebody to take off their heavy winter coat, don't be a cold, biting wind. Be a warm, gentle sun. And the remarkable thing were these two guys were warm, gentle sons. You were even handing them your card saying, come and visit, bring your family, you know, to Homeboy Industries. And they were downright hostile and awful, I found. But 5 hours later, when they personally escorted them to a plane to fly back to New York, I went on to Toronto. They shook their hands and said, if it was up to us, we'd let you in. And that's only because you had transformed them through your own kindness and care. And that's powerful because we think that in your face or a cold biting wind is the thing that's ultimately powerful. But in the end, it's the warm, gentle sun that really transformed these guys from demonizing you because that's really what they did from the gate. To finally getting to know that you are human beings.
And also seeing that this was Lewis and Fabian's reaction to being mistreated.
Right. Yes.
I mean,
it was extraordinary.
We know so many people who, if you tell them, you know, they can't put that, they can't take that water on board, are going to have a fit. You know? So I'm sure that crucible of, they knew that they were mistreating you. This is Terrence McNally. You're listening to my April 2010 conversation with Father Gregory Boyle, founder of Homeboy Industries, and Luis Perez, one of Homeboy's senior staff. I want to talk a little bit about the whole situation of gangs and so on. And one quote I found interesting, or at least I think people will want to get underneath this one, is you write in the book, though I don't regret having orchestrated truces and treaties, I'd never do it again. The unintended consequences of it all was that it legitimized the gangs, fed them oxygen. I eventually came to see that this kind of work keeps gangs alive. How so? I mean, obviously, over the years, there have been truces, there have been treaties, and they've usually been celebrated as a step in the right direction.
Yeah, I think part of the thing is that the outsider view always drives the inside of this issue. So outsiders go, my gosh, this is Middle East, this is Northern Ireland. Let's get the two sides together and talk this out. And they'll even use the word peacemaking, and who can be against peacemaking? But peacemaking requires conflict, and there is no conflict in gang violence. There's violence, but there's no conflict, which is to say it's not about anything. You couldn't sit people down. You couldn't say, work what out?
In other words, there's nothing to negotiate.
There's nothing to negotiate. And so even if you got the, I wouldn't even say shock collars, even if you got the ones who are most inclined to be violent, who are those people? Well, they're the most damaged, they're the most despondent, and they're in many cases the most mentally ill. They aren't people who are trying to kill anybody, truthfully. They go into enemies' neighborhoods hoping to die, not hoping to kill. So you have to kind of just say, well, this isn't about conflict. This isn't about working stuff out. And you also don't want to say that the gangs are okay as long as they're benign. You know, this morning at camp, I asked a kid, I asked where he was from, and he told me what gang he was from. And I said, tell me something. Do you regret that you got into your neighborhood, into your gang? And he thought about it a second. He goes, no. I said, well, one day you will. And that's the day you'll know that you are a real man. And he was a little shocked by it. And I said, because you cannot name a single good thing that's come into your life because of your gang. And then I pointed at his arm that had a huge tattoo. And I said, and yet you want to dedicate your life to it and you'd give your life for it. And yet there's not a single thing you can name, can you? And he said, no, there isn't. I said, and one day you'll look in the mirror and you'll say, my gang is not about anything at all. And that's the day you'll know that you're a man. And I said, I just let him have it. Whenever most kids always say, yeah, I do regret it.
Ah.
But he hadn't, you know, and I thought, well, that's okay. One day you'll be a man. And I said, you'll find people in your neighborhood who are 30 years old, but this does not guarantee that this is a man. It's just sometimes it's
a
third grader who happens to have lived for as long as 30 years.
I saw you shake your head yes when he said that, in fact, they go into enemy territory hoping to die. And you shook your head at that. What is that about?
Well,
this is Luis Perez.
Yeah, well, you know, first and foremost, you know, just the philosophy of Homeboy in our community now is that we don't work with gangs, we work with gang members. And the difference in that is that when you have a crowd of people who hurt and suffer in the same way, it's very hard to get to the one that really wants to change what he's doing when you're in a crowd of people that are all in agreement on what they want to do. You go to these places seeking to cause hurt, but truly you're just hurt, and that's why you're going in there to be, in some ways, healed, hopefully with death, right? The truth is there's never someone, no hopeful kid that gets into a gang. He gets into a gang because he's fleeing something from home. Unfortunately, sometimes you ask youth, guys that are in camp or juvenile hall, when I go and do talks or at high schools or junior highs, and you ask them, why did you join a gang? Oh, it's because it's my family, or it's because they're the people that love me. And the honest truth, that answer is only verifying that at home, there's a lack of either love, compassion, or caring for them, you know? And they're trying to find people that are just as hurt as they are. You know, and when you join a gang, the thing is that a lot of times people that have tattoos on them or whatever the case may be, and I also have tattoos myself, but the thing is you're told this when you first get into the gang. I got in when I was 13 years old, and, you know, I'm 30 years old now. And when I first got into the gang, I wasn't told, you're get into this game, and you'll say it's like a game, right? But you're not told the whole rules. Because what ends up happening as a juvenile, you're incarcerated, and you may have rivals on the streets and rivals when you go into juvenile hall. But once you go to state prison, the guy that used to be your enemy has to become your friend, because it's not about gangbanging anymore. It's not about you're from that side, I'm from this side. It becomes this is our race and that's your race. It becomes a race thing. So that means that.
So in other words, I thought that your enemy would be perhaps the authorities, but no, you're saying within the correctional institutions.
No, by enemy he means, you know, my gang enemy.
Yeah, but I'm saying it becomes race against race once you're in
North and South.
North and South, or it becomes Hispanics against African Americans. And so right there, you're not rivaling against a guy that from another gang in your area. You're rivaling against a race, another ethnic background, right? And so what ends up happening is you may even be celled up with a guy that's from an enemy's neighbor that you would think consider an enemy on the streets becomes your best friend. And what ends up happening, then you get out, and then once again the rival starts again, right?
So two people can align themselves against another race in prison, both are released, they're enemies again?
Yeah.
And they might kill each other?
And that's the being hypocrite, right? That's the lie of the game, right? You're told that you're against this person. And that's when, unfortunately, lots of times it takes a while before you actually see the truth. And you can actually see is, what am I actually fighting for? If I don't stand for something, I really don't stand for nothing at all, you know? And you're standing for this gang, and you got tattoos, and you're willing to die for it and serve a life sentence behind it. But then when you go in there, you just killed this guy that you may end up finding out that you really like the guy that you really would have liked him, right? Because you're so much alike.
Yeah, and so it's all about neighborhoods and boundaries and streets, and I mean, that's really all it's...
There's a lot of history to a lot of things, and a lot of you could say there's a lot of petty stuff in regards to...
How much does the drug trade have to do with it? I would think a conception is that... I'm going to ask two questions about the drug trade. One, that there's competition about the drug trade, and is that what's motivating? It doesn't sound like that's it at all. The other is, are people making money from the drug trade? I mean, gang members, are they making a good living?
You know, I went to this retreat one time in up north. I just came back from it, from a men's retreat in Los Altos, and this man talked about these three things that people seek in their life all the time. You know, money, power, and prestige, right? And then they in recovery, in the 12 steps, they talked about money, property, or prestige divert us from our primary purpose. And that's what happened. It's a lack of, there's a lack of hope. There's a lack of opportunity. You grow up in an environment where negativity surrounds you all the time. And in life, every child wants to be something. Unfortunately, there's a lack of opportunity. And the projects, the housing projects, are in the community where all you see around you, that the guy that's, you know, selling drugs or doing things like that, the negative stuff, kind of seems like that's the thing to do. So,
well, but wait,
you're drawn to that.
I'm asking if, you know, right now jobs are hard to come by for everyone. And then for, you know, the poor, it's higher. And for African Americans, Latinos, unemployment's higher and so on. Is the drug trade actually an attractive financial place for a young person with no other hope?
I would think not for a smart person, because of the consequences after, right?
if you read Freakonomics, he's got it half right. He'll say in there that, just examine the street level person, the in our day, you know, the kid who used to run up to the car to sell crack cocaine or something, he's making about $3 an
McDonald's
hour.
McDonald's wages, right?
Maybe $2 an hour. No, way
less.
Yeah. So people always think, on how are they going to accept a McDonald's job when they could be making money hand over fist? Well, it's a total myth. So he got it half right, where he says the street, anybody who's dealing drugs mainly is, nobody's buying the house in La Puente. They can barely get enough. So they haven't figured it out.
They're feeding their own habit and making just a little bit of money.
Well, maybe not even feeding their own habit. But they're making very little money.
Yeah.
So then he asks the next question. This is where he blows it. He says, so why would a kid risk prison and death for $2 an hour, $3 an hour. And his answer to that was really cockamamie. He ends up saying it's the same reason why a waitress works in a restaurant hoping for the break to be recognized as an actress, or the football player goes to practice hoping someday to make it to the majors. Crazy. He thinks the reason why somebody risks death and prison is to someday become
a kingpin,
Drug dealer. But the real reason, of course, that somebody risks death in prison is because they do not care. And that's the part people don't get, because they stand outside. And God love Anderson Cooper. He was interviewed by him twice for this special that he had. And he asked this question twice, not of me, but of an active gang member. He says, I don't see the attraction. And that's because he presumes there's something attractive in it. And that's the outsider view. So people say that there's something must be attractive. And the author of Freakonomics looks at it and says, oh, well, they must be hoping for the day when they become the
because he puts himself in their place. And from his worldview, his life experience, must be it.
Or even from a rational sense of things. And this is, trust me, not rational. And that's one of the reasons why most of the things that we've tried do not work, because we think we're dealing with rational actors who are engaged in rational activity. And the truth is, doesn't work at a level of reason.
It's all about damage and loss.
It's all about a lethal absence of hope. And gangs are the places kids go when they've encountered their life as a misery, and misery loves company. So if you can infuse this population with a sense of sure and certain hope, then you've really done something. But you can't scare a kid straight, and you can't make a kid understand what hope is by terrifying them or threatening them with sanctions or whatever it is. They just don't care.
Or as you say, any method that would be derived from a rational analysis is probably off, because...
And that's part of the thing that undergirds a lot of law enforcement's response, is a presumption that these are rational actors. And so everything from three strikes to whatever strategy, they're all kind of think twice laws. Oh, I know. He'll think twice if the threat, you know, if we could send him to prison for the rest of his life.
But he doesn't think once.
He doesn't think once, exactly, because he doesn't care. And so all that stuff works with folks who care, because they're thinking, because they imagine a future and they can conjure up an image of what tomorrow is. But for somebody for whom that's foreign, it will not matter how you threaten them, because they don't care. So you have to try something different, which is get the person to end up caring about his present.
Right. You've got to change that state. The state from hopelessness to the possibility of hope.
Well, if you ask the guys at Homeboy Industries, and this is a curious thing, suddenly they care about whether they live or die. Before, they didn't.
Yeah.
And, you know, suddenly they have things like fear.
In other words,
and they never had fear before.
Going home from Homeboy down a street they've traveled many times now feels different?
Yes.
Now they take a different route, or now they
now
care.
Now they care.
Wow. I mean, that's at the level, you know, at a level that's so concrete and so real. That's a really powerful image. In other words, until that day, back and forth up and down that street doesn't matter, because you don't care, so you don't fear.
Exactly.
Yeah. Wow.
And it feels like fearlessness is, and in that definition, is courage, but it isn't. This is a person who has ceased to care, and that's a dangerous person. So you want to be able to get out there and give them a reason to get up in the morning and a reason not to gangbang the night before.
Yeah. I'm Terrence McNally. That's the voice of Gregory Boyle. He's here in the studio with me, along with Luis Perez, who's worked at Homeboy Industries for 6 years. Father Gregory Boyle has finally written a book, Tattoos on the Heart, The Power of Boundless Compassion. You can learn more about their work at Homeboy Industries. We've certainly talked about Homeboy. Let me ask you a couple of more questions about it. What is, both or either of you can answer this question, what's the meaning of tattoo removal?
It's, like I told the story right now about Marcos and other people that come in through our offices. I have a friend, and he was completely covered in tattoos, which he's from another gang, and if it would have been years back, we probably would have never hanged out together. But we went to do a talk one time, and this guy came up to him, pretty big guy, 6-something, big guy. He asks him, "Wow, those are a lot of tattoos." He's completely covered in his face. He asks him, "Wow, those are a lot of tattoos. Why do you have them?" And he's like, "It's a mask. I'm hiding from myself." And that was one of the most conscious answers I've ever heard. So truthful. And that's what tattoo removal provides, is the opportunity to take that mask off and allow someone to see themselves for who they are. And it's so important, because so many people pass judgment on what they see on the outer appearance instead of what's inside a person. So.
But since that is the truth, the tattoo removal, I mean, because people judge by the outside, the tattoo removal actually makes a difference?
Yes, it does. It allows people to see them for who they are.
But it's also, you know, it's an obstacle to employment. Nobody,
yeah,
you know, this
exactly.
guy, nobody's going to hire this guy but me.
You know? Right, if they're ever yeah. going to work anywhere but Homeboy.
Yeah, yeah. So, you know, so the famous story of the guy Frank who had came in with F the world across
right.
his forehead, and it just filling the whole thing like a billboard on his forehead. And you know, of course, he says, "I'm having a hard time finding a job," you know? So tattoo removal was born with this guy named Frank, who, you know, I went to go get a doctor at White Memorial Hospital, and he donated some time, and pretty soon we had a waiting list of 1,000. And so, A, it helped him to get a job, and now he's a security guard at a movie studio. But everybody else comes in for with their own reasons. You know, they used to lift their shirt up and have their tattoo across their chest. And you just, God, this is such a long process. Just keep your shirt on. We'll just do the stuff that's visible. No one will see it. And then they'll say, "Yeah, but my son will." So then that became the reason to go ahead and remove any tattoo they wanted. So it sends a message to friend and foe alike, but it also it says something about who you don't want to hide anymore. And, you know, we have several, you know, a lot of guys who have covered their faces, and you kind of – psychologically, what is going on there? You know, how much pain is this person in? And it's not just a mask. It's also, it says this kind of has a sign that's in prison, I think, kind of a keep away. Yeah. I'm crazy. Don't mess with me. It's a way of protecting yourself a little bit, don't you think?
Yeah, I believe it is.
Well, masks work both ways.
Yeah.
Right? It's the mask to frighten the other and a mask to hide behind.
That's
exactly.
right.
Yeah.
Exactly right.
So nowadays, how many businesses is Homeboy in? What's the current status of the place? And then what's your annual budget, and how much does your business make, and how much do you need to raise each year?
Yeah, well, we have 5 businesses at the moment. We have 427 employees, and some are senior staff like Lewis, about 60 of those who kind of run the place and supervise others.
And that's another 375 or so who are not senior staff, right?
Yeah, and so they're what we call trainees. So they're either in job training programs in our 5 businesses, or they're in the work readiness program where they work in the headquarters. So, our annual budget is $10 million, and $3.5 million is generated by the revenue from the businesses.
And so, just so people know, what is Homeboy?
Homeboy Bakery, Homeboy Silkscreen,
that's T-shirts and things.
Where we print T-shirts for. We have 2,500 customers, so that's a really thriving business from all over the country. And then Homeboy Homegirl merchandise, where we sell our logo stuff, mugs, shirts, mouse pads. You know. Homegirl Cafe, Homeboy Maintenance. Did I miss one?
And
I think it's 5.
You mentioned in your in the book that Homeboy Plumbing didn't work.
That's right. Yeah, who knew people didn't want gang members in their homes? You know, so that was I didn't see that one coming.
But so the business generates 3.5. And so you've got about 6.5.
And that's climbing, which is a nice thing.
Good.
That keeps going.
But that 6.5, you have to raise each
that's
year
right.
to do this.
That's a lot of dough. So,
and especially in the last couple of years, right?
Yeah, yeah. I mean, we just met payroll this last time. It's a tough thing. You know, you hope for angels in this whole thing. And, you know, it's an expensive venture, but it would be costlier to imagine us not existing, because we really release steam in this whole gang issue in L.A. And even for quite apart from the 12,000 gang members we assist every year, there are 86,000 gang members in L.A. County. And, And we really provide hope for those who are incarcerated at the moment and those who aren't ready to walk through our doors. It's a little bit like a rehab center for an active drug addict. It, you know, if you didn't have that there to kind of say, one day this could be yours if you walk through the door, it really operates in the same psychological way of being a beacon of hope.
We've got about three minutes left. Let me read a couple of quotes about the God part of this, right? The desire of God's heart is larger than our imaginations can conjure. This longing of God's to give us peace and assurance and a sense of well-being only awaits our willingness to cooperate with God's limitless magnanimity. How do you reconcile that with the pain, the cruelty, the selfishness, the greed, and so on that we see around us, God's limitless magnanimity?
Well, you know, again, this has sort of been the question forever about God, you know, is all-powerful, all-loving, and people will claim both. But the focus really, I think, is the all-loving part, the God who's too busy loving us to be disappointed. And we're endlessly creating God in our own image as if God is as tiny-spirited as we might be, you know. So God is just endlessly giving and loving and compassionate and merciful. And that we're called to imitate the kind of God we believe in. So, and then we choose badly only all the time in terms of our own selfishness and greed and ability to strike the high moral distance that separates us. So, you know, Jesus has a point where he says that you may be one as the Father and I are one. It's about kinship. It's about the unity between us. It's not about how can we just have sort of this unitive experience with God. God's more interested with us being in kinship. And that's the original covenant. The covenant was, God says in the Old Testament, as I have loved you, we expect him to say, please love me back. But instead what he says, as I have loved you, so must you have this particular same kind of love for the widow, orphan, and the stranger. Very, very specific. And of course, Homeboy Industries is only about orphans. And it's a really about living out of that kind of love and commitment to these three classes of folks who throughout time have always been with us, the widow, the orphan, and the stranger. And
let me read one more quote.
Sure.
To be in the world who God is, here is what we seek, a compassion that can stand in awe at what the poor have to carry, rather than stand in judgment at how they carry it.
Yeah, I think we're endlessly trying to judge, and that's not our best selves, and that's not the greatest reflection of the kind of person God longs for in us. So once you get to this place of being able to stand in awe, wow, I've never had to carry what Louis Bettis has had to carry. And so I stand in awe, to say nothing of love and admiration, but awe at his ability to kind of navigate his life. And, you know, and I never in my life have had to carry what he's had to carry. So rather than judging him for his past gang life or drug use, it feels more appropriate to just kind of admire, you know, how he's navigated, you know, the hand he's been dealt. And now he's able to, in fact, help any number of young people who were in the same situation that he was before he turned his life around.
Okay, I'm going to wrap this up. Thank you, Father Gregory Boyle. Thank you, Louis Perez, for sharing this with us and for the work you're doing. The book is Tattoos on the Heart. The website is homeboysindustries.org, homeboyindustries.org. To learn more about the show, guests, podcasts, articles, and so on, you can visit me at terrencemcnally.net, terrencemcnally.net, or A World That Just Might Work, all one word, aworldthatjustmightwork.com. They're the same website. You can listen to podcasts there at iTunes. You can sign up there at iTunes to have the podcast delivered to you weekly. You can also sign up there or by emailing me at temcnally@mac.com, temcnally@mac.com, to get my weekly email telling you who's going to be on, what we're going to talk about, and three or four articles of background. You can also check out Free Forum with Terrence McNally on Facebook and follow me on Twitter at McNally Terrence. You've been listening to Free Forum, and this is the Progressive Voices channel on TuneIn.
I'm David Pakman, host of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. Check out this clip from my show. I do want to talk about this story, even though it's still very, very early. We don't have all of the information yet, but we do have some important and very, very disturbing information. 11 victims plus a police officer are dead, along with the shooter, at yet another public mass shooting. This one happened at the Borderline Bar and Grill in Thousand Oaks, California. Very full bar last night. Shooter opens fire, kills 11 people, as well as a police officer who was responding to the incident. The shooter also dead from a self-inflicted gunshot wound. And about a dozen other people have been injured. And police spokespeople have described the scene as horrific, with blood everywhere. The shooter has been identified. It is indeed another young white male, 28 years old, heavily tattooed, was part of the initial description that was released. We've now learned that he was a former U.S. Marine who showed up with a 45 caliber handgun, which had been reportedly legally purchased, as well as a or multiple smoke devices. At this time, once again, it's being reported that the shooter took his own life, not shot by police. It's also been reported that in April of this year, there was an incident involving the shooter that led to a mental health evaluation, which ended with the shooter being cleared by mental health experts. And there are some early reports that some of the people inside at yesterday's shooting were also at the location, at the event of the Las Vegas shooting that happened not that long ago, which is just unimaginable. I mean, just even having enough mass shootings that you've got people who are at more than one is extraordinarily disturbing. And we already know what will happen if and when the motivations of this individual become clear, if they ever do, because we often don't actually end up getting clarity. If it's a right winger, then it's just a person who did this for no reason related to their politics whatsoever. If it's a left winger, as they're already sort of priming the pump with by saying this was country music night at the bar, even in Thousand Oaks, if you go to country music night, you must be a right winger, meaning the shooter was targeting right wingers, of course, without any evidence whatsoever at this time. If it is a left winger, they will create a counter narrative that will completely ignore the string of right wing terror in the United States. And it's too early to tell. It's very early in the story, but we should put politics completely aside for a moment, if it's possible, and realize that this is just happening too often, because even that you can't get universal agreement on. You actually see comments online from people who say, country of 340 million people, even if it's statistically super safe, there are still going to be lots of these, and many people even refusing to acknowledge that this is a problem. Hopefully more information soon. Just another absolutely horrible incident. You've been listening to part of The David Pakman Show on the Progressive Voices channel. For full audio and video podcasts, interviews, and more, go to davidpakman.com and check out our YouTube channel at youtube.com/The David Pakman Show.
Whether you're listening to me, Mark Levine, every Monday and Thursday,
or me, Leslie Marshall, each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday,
you can hear us from 3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.
Here's a sample of what you'll hear. Mr. Fred Redmond, VP at the USW for Human Affairs. Mr. Redmond, can you speak to the division? Can you speak to the inequality and the need for unity, and how unity is and can be and must be stronger than hate?
America is better than this, and we think that the rhetoric has gone too far, and we think big as a civil society and as people who live in what's supposed to be a democracy, is that we should be able to discuss our differences. And we just think that this sort of carnage must end, and must end now. And people should come together and be able to discuss their differences in a civil manner.
Again, that's Mark Levine every Monday and Thursday.
And Leslie Marshall each Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday.
3 to 4 p.m. Eastern Time on the Progressive Voices Network.